Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Texter here says, Brendan, the IRFU will have a massive task to hold on to Farrell when the English come looking for him. That's from Damien. It seems like Andy Farrell is quite committed and quite embedded in Ireland Butcher. Yeah, I mean, who knows? Anyway, we'll move on. My next guests have written an extraordinary behind-the-scenes look at the hidden world of Irish prisoners. It's aptly named Unlocked. Former prison officer David MacDonald, examiner journalist Mick Clifford. Good morning.
Good morning, Brendan.
Mick, prisons are not a thing most of us spend much time thinking about, are they? It's kind of out of sight, out of mind in a way, isn't it?
Completely, Brendan, and I suppose that's reflected in the attitudes in the body politic to it, and the general attitude is keep it over there in the corner because there are no votes in it compared to, for example, if you see attitudes towards Garda Síochán in that because they interact with the public on a regular basis in one capacity or another. The body politic is always interested in what's going on there, resources, etc., all that kind of thing. Prisons, no, it's keep it over there, out of the way, because basically the only thing that can come out of it, as far as a lot of people in politics are concerned, is bad news, and therefore they don't want to know about it. Problem with that is, you know, as you can see in the book and as Dave will relate, standards start dropping, the attitudes towards prisoners in terms of resources for rehabilitation, all that sort of thing. And one of the biggest things of all, there's a huge number of people in Irish prisons that should not be there simply because they're there largely because they have mental health difficulties of one sort or another. That's been shown time and again in research. So it's a hidden corner of Irish life to that extent.
Yeah, yeah. And look, David, the book does throw a lot of light into that hidden corner. Before we get into that, just in terms of you, in a way, your card was marked from the start because you grew up in Portlaoise. And Portlaoise, weirdly, was kind of a prison boom town in the 70s, wasn't it?
It was, Brendan. Kind of, you could call it, maybe describe it as a bit of a garrison town. I grew up about 400 metres from Portlaoise prison, which was the only prison there at the time. The Midlands came much later. It was, you know, I went to school with prison officers' sons and daughters and would have known prison officers from sporting events, and I worked in a bar and they would come in, and it was the main employer in the town and it was a very good employer, but it probably still is the most main job that you could have in Portlaoise, between the Midlands and Portlaoise prison. So yeah. It was interesting.
Just as an example of how it kind of saturated the culture of the town, just one little thing, like, tell us about your date with the governor's daughter.
It was a little bit tricky to date anyone from the prison, not just the governor's daughter, but I met this lady who I liked. I was about 16 at the time. I asked her out on a date, which was to the cinema. I went to near her house where I met her, down the old Dublin Road. We were followed by two detectives because her dad was a governor and they were protected by armed detectives. Didn't mind too much the whole thing. The car following us down the Dublin Road, but when they actually came into the cinema and sat a couple of seats behind me, it was a bit of a passion breaker. It didn't work very well. And every time I turned around, they just were winking at me. So it was tough.
And listen, I gathered that in Portlaoise back then to go on and become a prison officer would have been a great gig, and that was kind of a thing a lot of lads did. But you decided to go off and try and fight your destiny, if you will. You went off to Dublin, lived a bit, did some other jobs, got married, met your wife Valerie and that. Yeah. But you drifted back eventually, yeah?
Yeah, back in the day, you kind of have to remember, Brendan, there wasn't the array of jobs that there is now. You know, there was the bright ones got the bank and the thicker ones got the guards or the prison service. So it was a stable job. Out of my class alone of about 40 that did leaving cert with me, nearly 20, half of us ended up in the prison. So we were kind of destined to it a little bit. And I had a curiosity about it because I'd walk by the prison every day. Prison officers back then certainly didn't talk about what went on behind the walls of the prison. It was kept very secretive. So I had a bit of a curiosity to see what it was like getting through those gates of the prison.
Yeah. No, the thing is, you read the book and the first chapter, you get a Category 5 death threat. And like the first thing I'm thinking is like, why would anyone become a prison officer? Do you have to be a particular type, do you think?
I don't think you're a particular type, but I think the prison can mould you when you actually get the job. And look, being honest, it's not a job for everybody. But look, it's a very stressful job, and the people that are working today and every other day inside the walls of those prisons, they some absolutely exceptional officers, totally professional, do their job really to the best of their ability under very, very difficult circumstances. But it's like any job. I mean, an ambulance driver is a tough job, going to maybe a scene of an accident, or a fireman going to a fire where people have been very badly hurt. So you get used to it, like any job. You it moulds you. And there is very much, there still is a very much a us and them, if you like.
Yeah.
So there's the officers and there's the prisoners. Now, that's broken down quite a lot over the last number of years. But there is still that camaraderie ship that's there, and you just get on with it.
Yeah. Mick, is that when you were doing the book, it must have made you think of the cops, like, and that kind of tribal mentality a bit. Is it like a band of brothers?
Yeah,
like,
there's that esprit de corps, I suppose, one way of putting it. But at the same time, it is a circle the wagons mentality. You know, it can turn into that. But I think it is, I suppose, and, you know, it comes out through the book as well, to a certain extent, an amount of that is necessary, because you're going to have a small cohort of the prisoners who are there basically to disrupt. And some of them, for instance, want to continue the criminal activities they're at on the outside, a small cohort. So they're going to view any way they can undermine the situation. They're going to look at it like that. Others are entirely frustrated and they want to have a go at it. So you can understand then why the officers...
It needs to be a wall, basically.
No, yeah, having said that, at the same time, and Dave goes into it, that doesn't necessarily mean you can't have interaction and you can't have a situation whereby at some level... with most prisoners, you realise you're both there of a job to do. The prisoners are there to serve their time, and let's see if we can get on that way.
Yeah, yeah. I get the impression, David, that there's things throughout the book, when you look back on them now, and maybe at the time it seemed normal or something, and you look back now and you go, just that was all wrong. But one of the first things was, you started in Mountjoy, was one of your first postings, and you were down in the section of the prison that had the HIV prisoners. This was very much the early days of AIDS, when people probably didn't understand it that well either. Yeah. But just paint that picture, because it's a very, very bleak chapter.
It is, and Mick does an amazing job on it. Even if I told the story, it still, when I read it, makes the hair stand on the back of my neck. It, as you say, Brendan, it was back at a period of time when no one had any understanding of AIDS and HIV. It was a death sentence then. Some famous people were dying from it. Rock Hudson, Freddie Mercury, people like that had passed away from it. The base in Mountjoy would be under the B wing. It was a horrible place.
When you say under the B wing, it was literally underground.
Literally underground. It was a basement, as described. It had no natural light. It was rodent infested, both with mice and cockroaches the size of mice. It was stink. It had a tiny, tiny exercise yard that was completely walled in with razor wire. The cells were dingy, the windows basically let no natural light in, and a small little rec hall. The problem was that this was a knee-jerk reaction by the prison service. We didn't understand, and in fairness to them, no one did understand the effects of AIDS and HIV. So,
and not to put too fine a point in it, but a lot of these guys, they were living out the end of their days in this situation, were they?
Absolutely. I mean, the heading of that chapter is Dead Men Walking, and that's exactly what they were, unfortunately. I was fortunate. My wife worked for the HSE as a chief researcher into the AIDS, so I had a bit of better knowledge of what was going on. But the myths were there. If someone spat on you, you were contaminated. If you drank from the same cup, if their sweat touched you, you know, all this sort of thing was going to make you infected. And I mean, in the book, we describe how the Mater Hospital is directly across the road from Mountjoy. So very often we'd actually walk the prisoners over to the matter. And one particular day, I brought this young guy over. I was accompanied by two other prison officers. I was handcuffed to the prisoner. We went into a room. A doctor came in. He asked, could we step outside? He wanted to talk to his patient. There was a window in the room, so I just turned to the prisoner and said, you know, I can't. You knew by the doctor's demeanour this was not going to be good news. I nodded to the other two staff. They stood outside, and as delicately as possible, the doctor told this young man that he had months to live. So We went outside, we lit a cigarette, we had a chat, and I can still remember him turning to me and saying, "I'm fucked, aren't I?" And he was. 3 months later, he was dead. And I was bringing him back to this hellhole, which was the base.
And were any concessions made to these men who were men largely, I presume?
Yeah,
who were dying, like in terms of, I don't know, visits, food?
No, it was actually the other way around. Their visits were curtailed because of where they were located within the prison. Their food had to be brought further because, again, where they were located, and they were served on everything that was disposable. So paper plates, paper cups, plastic knife and fork, and everything was dumped because the fear was that you could catch AIDS from, if they used a knife or fork was reused again. No, there was nothing. The only concession that was really made was in some of their cases, as they got very, very bad, some were brought to hospice to die, some to hospital, and some were given temporary release towards the end.
Okay, now, on the other hand then, entirely, you moved to Port Leash then, and obviously Port Leash was home to a lot of political prisoners at that stage. Tell me about the subversives in Port Leash, the IRA, INLA guys, who basically ran their own operation within the prison.
They did. They saw themselves as a military force, so they had their own command structure. So we didn't actually, we did lock up the prisoners, but like, for example, at night time at fall in, their commanding officer would go to the top of the landing and he'd bring them all to attention at their cell door. They'd do an about turn and in they go, and only then did we go down.
Oscar Ilga as well.
Oscar, yeah. And you had always had to remember, like when I went to Port Leash first, we could have had 400 or 500 subversives. If you had trouble in Mountjoy, it was usually with 2-3 people, and we could manage it quite easily. But in Port Leash, if you had an issue, they all worked together. So you'd have a problem with 400 or 500 prisoners. And that would have been very difficult to deal with. So they had...
So the only option was to stay hands off from the situation, really.
Absolutely. They didn't speak to us. We didn't speak to them. If they wanted something, they went to their commanding officer, who would have gone to one of our chief officers. And that's how the communication worked. We didn't have any... we didn't talk to them. They didn't talk to us.
Okay, but was discipline effectively managed? Was there a punishment meted out, that kind of thing?
They did it themselves. So there was an agreement, for example, that if someone got temporary release to go to a funeral or a wedding or a baptism, if they didn't come back, they were brought back by their own. And very often, when that they would arrive back in the boot of a car, worse for wear, thrown out at the main gate, and then the commanding officer might give him a punishment of 3 months scrubbing toilets with his toothbrush or something. You know, this sort of.
Okay.
Sport.
Okay. So yeah, you're messing things up for all of us here. Was the message there? Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Listen, I presume. I mean, it's a grim kind of existence in one way, but I'd say you have to have a sense of humour to get you through it at times as well. Like there are. Darkly comic moments, you call them in the book. Tell me, let's keep it delicate enough now, but tell me about the conjugal visits.
Yeah, well, there weren't actually allowed conjugal visits. It was just an unwritten rule. When they went on visits, it wasn't your typical visits where there can be 8 or 9 in a long visiting box. They had sort of just like in a cabin pack where they were one-to-one with their visitor. And our job would be to sit in a chair in the corner and made sure we brought the examiner or something in with us to keep it our eyes in a different direction. Got very good at doing crosswords, so you'd know what was going on, but you didn't stare it down. And the rule they had was that if we didn't search their visitors in any thorough way, that they would allow themselves after the visit to be searched. So they would be completely stripped and searched after the visit, shoes x-rayed, all this type of thing.
Okay.
It's interesting about that, Brendan. Sorry. That was the subversives Dave was referring to. But if you look at the difference with the way the authorities down here treated the subversives, as we're calling the IRA, and the way they were treated in prisons in the north, and what evolved in the H blocks and the hunger strikes, and then what politically that set off. Quite obviously down here, they decided they were going to take a softly approach. And you have to say, in retrospect, they were very right to do so. Because
pragmatic.
Yeah, very pragmatic.
Yeah, you also had a job as a kind of a censor. And again, we'll keep this delicate, but this is fascinating. So this is back in the days of VHS videos.
That's
and
right.
So if someone's partner or wife sent them in a VHS video, you had to have a screening of it before it was given to them.
You did. I mean, often I got one of the cassettes in the first 20 minutes could be on wild horses in Afghanistan, and then the next thing shoots to a very attractive lady on a bed doing things.
Okay.
The problem with that was that maybe the week after that, I'd meet that same lady coming in on a visit, fully clothed, obviously, but coming in on a visit, and it was kind of hard not to imagine what you were seeing. So they were trying every which way to get it.
But the videos were handed on. Discretion was the better part of valor.
Yeah, there was kind of a rule as well that if you gave a video in like that, you'd have a quick word with the prisoner and you would say, it's not for general consumption here. We don't want to see that in the rec hall, you know.
Let's leave that one there. We let discretion be the better part of valor. There's an interesting part to the censor thing, I thought, as well. Look, in a way, you needed to be a kind of a psychologist as well. Explain to me about the Dear John letters and how that had to be handled.
Well, like, it does happen. Women do stand by prisoners that are doing big sentences, but very often they don't. And things can happen. They can perhaps get pregnant and then they're sending in the Dear John letter, and or they can just meet someone else. And when you're the prisoner and you receive something like that, it's going to cause you anguish, depression, and you're always afraid that they may do something. Like, you're at the back of your mind, suicide is always there, that could happen. So you just have to, what you would have to do is you'd have to try and be as delicate around that type of thing as possible. You couldn't not give the letter to the prisoner, but you'd make sure that you spoke to maybe some of his friends that he, you know, that were on the landing or whatever, to keep an eye on him. You would talk to the class officer that would be on the landing. The class officer is someone who actually runs a landing with prisoners. And you might even talk to the chaplain or whatever to maybe have a word with him. But this would cause a lot of prisoners a lot of anguish. Not everyone is going to wait 10 years for their loved one to come out.
And you were in there with no options and nothing else on your mind. Like, I can imagine it would eat guys up.
We had even cases of, I mean, when I worked on the OSG, we had a case of a very serious Limerick gangster. His wife came in and she had been coming in on a regular basis. And when I looked at her, you just knew she was pregnant. And I just took her to one side and said, are we going to have a problem? She said, I don't know about you, but I am. And so we just had to line up staff outside the visiting box. And obviously he went ballistic. And we had to get her out safely and get him back to his cell safely, you know. So.
And listen, are we watching too many movies, or do relationships develop in prison?
No, they don't. Prisoners on occasion can maybe fall for a female prison officer. That can happen, you know.
Yeah.
You got to remember, Brendan, these people are inside a wall. They don't have the life you and we have outside. It's completely different. They don't have the same contact with loved ones. And you will get prisoners who will, for want of a better word, fall for maybe a female officer and make advances. But it wouldn't be that they'd be dragged into a cell as such. It'd be that they would just get smitten badly. And in that case, then, what we would have to do is get that prisoner to a different prison, just transfer him.
Yeah. Listen, another thing you feel bad about is, and some people might remember this incident a bit, in 1997, the defaulters. Just tell me about that.
A group of serious thugs took five prison officers hostage, and they put them through an absolute horrendous time, up to including one of them threatening to make one of the officers drink his blood, which he told the officer we knew he was HIV positive. The officer in question actually begged the prisoner to break every bone in his body rather than do that. These guys were put through a terrible time.
And syringes of blood up to a guy's neck
tying their necks to the door, that if the door was burst open, that they would choke, and this type of thing. Urinating on them. Just look, they were treated so badly. It's hard to describe on radio. It's probably better described in the book. Mm. But we got these down to Portlaoise. I was working in Portlaoise at the time, and they were treated. They were kind of being let off the hook. They were put onto E1 landing, which is known as where the heavies are kept. The landings above that in E Block 2, 3 and 4 are subversives, IRA, INLA. And the prisoners were going around high-fiving them, well done lads and all this type of thing. And I got up our noses badly. So the management were given an ultimatum. We are allowed to deal with these people in our way or we walk. And we would have walked out of Portlaoise prison. Everybody would have gone. So we got the go-ahead to deal with them. A wing in or London in D Division was quickly stripped, I mean, totally stripped, everything out of it. And we moved those prisoners into what was called D1, and we dealt with them. We were laying down a marker that this was never going to happen again.
Yeah.
And to be honest, it actually didn't. It hasn't happened.
Yeah. And you can understand why he felt the way he did and everything. Did. Tell us about the regime so that they were
the
under.
Regime initially was pretty much 23-hour lockup. When we opened the cell door, there was four officers in full riot gear. That's helmets, body armour and carrying shields. They would be handcuffed at the door. They would be walked to a very small exercise yard. They'd be given 30, 40 minutes in it and then walked back to the cell. Cell was bare, no TV. Later on, they were allowed radios. After a couple of months, they were allowed small transistors. They had nothing to do for 23 hours. It was solitary, pretty much confinement for that length of time. When they were allowed to have a visit, they were cuffed again at the cell door, walked 20 feet to the visiting box because there was one specially set up for them. And again, the officers, we were there in full riot gear. Their food was mush, because again, it was served to them on paper plates and very often left a bit longer than maybe necessary before they got it. It wasn't pleasant. It was probably, it wasn't right either. But I was part of it. And at the time, I felt it was right.
Yeah.
I'm not apologising for it. And I'm not knocking any of the officers that I worked with. I was part of that. And we did it for a very good reason at the time. We thought. But obviously, I think we obviously did it for way too long.
Yeah. You see, Mick, it would strike you that they're, I mean, OK, the prisoners have it much worse, obviously. The prison officers have a certain amount of power. But there's two sets of prisoners in this, in a way, aren't there? Like, there's two sets of people who are trapped in this kind of unhealthy dynamic.
Absolutely. And as I said, because everything that goes on there is effectively kept there, in the scenario like that, quite obviously, David and his colleagues, they were so put out by what had been done to the officers up in Mountjoy. This was the reaction on a human level. It's very understandable. And as Dave says himself, you know, that doesn't justify it or make it right. What was interesting was at the time, and there's court records there, when these prisoners were being brought up to courts, up to court, their lawyers were making obvious that this was the regime, but nobody paid a blind bit of notice at the time, which was interesting. Oh, that was on court reports at the time.
So was it in a sense of the law of the jungle in a way?
It was. I mean, look, Brendan, prisons have evolved, you know, the same society on the outside. But when that occurred, the prison officers in Port Leash, they were tough guys. They were hard men. These lads had seen real trouble with subversives.
Yeah.
They lived in fear both inside the walls of the prison and outside the walls of the prison. You know, they couldn't go on a holiday, for example, without first notifying the Department of Justice where they were going. And then they would usually use false names and never say what their job was.
Really?
When I worked in Port Leash, I was sent to the north to do a course, librarian course, basically. And like, you had to be met by someone, a detective from the RUC at the border. You had to be checked into a guest house. Your car was taken off you, taken away. Security was massive. The fear and what we used to call the troubles at that time had a huge impact on Port Leash and the people that worked there.
And David, can you leave it behind at all? Like, when you go home, presumably you can't talk to people about it. You probably can't talk to your family about it, can you?
You see, this is where I think people are wrong. I know many, many, many prison officers that when they go out the gate, conversation stops. They will not talk about what their day was like. They don't talk to their wife, their kids, nobody. That's why a lot of prison officers will drink together, holiday together, because they can't. But in my case, I was very lucky. My wife and me did speak about it. So I could go home and I could talk to Valerie and say, look, this was my day. This is what happened. I'm not proud of some of it. Some could be just a boring day, but I could talk to her. And I think that made a huge difference, Brendan.
And were you able to leave the prison officer behind? Like with your kids and with the family and all that?
Like, in truth, not always, no. I mean, if Valerie was here, she'd tell you that I'd come in the door at 8:30 and the first thing I'd bring in another prison officer that I'd worked with that day and talk to him for 2 hours.
Because he's the only one who understands.
Did happen.
Do guys get burnt out very young?
Yes, you do 30 years. That's what you can retire after 30 years. So, and to be honest with you, it's probably even 30 is too long.
You know. And I presume there's some guys who are burnt out, but who are still there for another 10 years and shouldn't be, probably.
Yeah, look, there is a new kind of officer coming in now where, say, the pub culture is not quite as popular as it used to be. You'll see guys going out at dinner time on their bicycles or for a run.
Yeah.
There's still a certain amount if it goes on. But it does, and I have seen it far too many times, people change, you know, and I've even speaking to, among prison officers, unfortunately, there's a very high rate of suicide. One of my best friends did it 6 months ago. You know, it's and someone that I never would have thought was in that position.
Yeah.
Drink was a big problem back in the day. And then as a new breed of officer comes along, now it could be on some occasions hard drugs like coke and what have you. Things okay. that I mean, the drug of choice back in my day was Guinness and Jameson. Now it's yeah. cocaine and pills.
And that's not an ideal situation. Presumably that puts them in compromising situations as well, doesn't it?
Massively, Brendan. I mean, yeah. you can't go into Tesco's and buy this stuff. So you're buying it off a drug dealer.
Yeah.
So once the dealer knows or gets to know who you are, they'll use you. You know.
Yeah. Which kind of brings us on to then the OSG and this unit that you were put in charge of. Tell us about the episode of Lifeline that led to the introduction of the OSG.
Yeah, it's a pretty famous one. Lifeline, Joe Duffy was on, I think, with Paul Williams and Christy Burke, who was a former Sinn Féin councillor. He was a Sinn Féin councillor at the time, independent now. And there's an argument over coverage of in the media about crime, whether, et cetera, that kind of thing. Anyway, next thing on the line comes this man, John Daly. It turns out very quickly he's ringing from Portlaoise prison. And then he said he had to go very quickly. Quite obviously somebody came in. There was outrage over the whole thing. Understandably, here was a fellow inside in prison contributing to a radio show. And directly as a result of that, they decided they accelerated plans to bring in bigger checks.
Tell us about the search first, though. I have it written down here if you don't have it offhand, right?
Yeah,
so they did a search. 8 phones, 3 SIM cards, 150 tablets, 30 syringes, and a budgie.
And a budgie, yeah. And there was various theories as to how the budgie actually got in there, which is
okay, we won't get into that.
But anyway, as a direct result of that, they decided to set up the operational support group. This was going to be dedicated to stopping contraband, principally drugs and phones coming into the prison. And I think Dave would say it changed the whole approach to things. I mean, for instance, the airport style machines that you now have to go through going into prisons, none of them were there anywhere except Portlaoise prior to that. And there were some chaotic scenes inside visiting rooms, like the Limerick gangs and that sort of thing were walking around handing over hot water bottle full of drink, and they were afraid that one would change a coat and walk out of the prison. So yeah. That really transformed the security from their point of view.
And like the ingenuity of how people got stuff in, which is detailed in the book, some of the various methods, is extraordinary.
It's unbelievable. I mean, the creativity that's applied, you'd wonder some of these people, if they're born somewhere else, they'd be in charge of corporations, what have you. But some of them, for instance, like the most amazing one was the Eastern European gang, where they had a guy who came down in the dead of night to Portlaoise with a fishing rod. He cast a line over the wall with a magnet on it. That hooked up with a magnet that the boys inside in the cells had. They set up a line, they brought in, and they put socks on the line, brought in pills, phones, everything. And the thing was such a success that they actually brought in spiced beef, a delicacy that there was in Lithuania at the time. I mean, you know, this is chunky stuff that they were bringing.
Yeah,
it was quite unbelievable. But there's loads of examples of that, and it's quite amazing.
Prosthetic leg was another.
It was, Brendan. We had a guy who used to have to go up to rehab in Dunleary on a regular basis. And basically what was happening was before he'd go up there, someone would go in to change the sanitary bin in the disabled toilet. And but that bin was full of phones, maybe 10, 15 smartphones. So an ordinary 20 euro phone in a prison is worth about 2,000 euros. They have massive value for a phone. Anywhere between 1,800 and 2,000.
And is that money is paid through intermediaries on the outside?
Yeah,
is there
Paddy Power accounts is a popular one.
Right.
This guy was...
And if you have a phone, you rent it out then to people?
You can rent it out. If you're caught with the phone, then you have to come up with the money. And there is some very sad stories surrounding that. I mean, the stories where you'd have Dave McDonald gets committed from the court straight into prison. I don't get to say goodbye to anyone. And I arrive in and this guy will come in and have a chat with me and play me up a bit and just say, listen, here, take a bang of the phone overnight. Bang being used to the phone for a call. And I'm very grateful that I can talk to my family from the cell. And he comes in the next morning, retrieves the phone, comes back 10 minutes later with two or three heavies with him and says, you broke the phone. You know, the phone's broken. Now, the phone isn't broken, but now I owe $2,000. And I don't have 2 cents to rub together. So the threat then is my wife or some of my family then are going to be used as mules to traffic stuff into the prison. Or in some cases, my mother might be sent off to Holland to act as a mule. And in other cases, prostitution. So. Wow.
Yeah, look, I mean, it's grim stuff. We were kind of laughing about some aspects to it, but it is grim, grim stuff. Mick, like, as you did the book over Zoom, I think, during lockdown. As you were wading through it and hearing the stories and everything, what were your takeaways from it? Like,
to be honest with you, at times, I knew Dave for a number of years before this, but at times it was jaw-dropping, the whole thing. I mean, there is, I mean, and I know it's a theme that people come back to, but there is definitely a far better way of doing things. Now, we always look to the Scandinavian countries, but there are examples in Finland, I think, in particular, where there's a more enlightened approach. And the big thing here is looking at the long term. It's looking at, this is not trying to be nice or make life better for people. Some people who are guilty of violent crimes. This is about trying to ensure that A, when they come out, they don't commit crime again, and B, if you want to put it down to finances, just the overall cost this is of people keeping people incarcerated. All of that can be approached in a different way. And the other big thing, as I said before, there are people in there with the type of conditions that if they were born in a better neighbourhood, they'd be getting treatment. Instead, they end up committing crime and being put inside in prison. And it's largely attributable to their conditions rather than any moral aspect towards fellow people, like, you know.
Yeah, yeah. And like, you would have to think, if your mental health wasn't already in trouble before you go into that kind of regime, I presume, like, that once guys are in there, David, it's a shocking effect.
Seen it hundreds of times, Brendan. Yeah. If you come into a prison or a prison environment where the regime is exactly the same, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, you don't get better, you get worse.
Yeah. And are most guys having some form of either rehab, or education, some kind of purpose, any of that?
Look, again, it has improved dramatically over number of years. I mean, when I went into the prison service first, I mean, the only kind of course that was given was maybe there might have been a woodwork class or maybe a bit of teaching of English, because a lot of prisoners at the time couldn't write or spell, or, you know, they were illiterate basically, or read. So that has improved massively and it's a lot better. But like, as Mick was saying, the cost of keeping a prisoner locked up, you're looking at approximately $110,000 for each prisoner, and that jumps double in Port Leash prison, where it's a high security prison.
Wow.
So, I mean, they're the stats from the Irish Prison Service. That's from the last ones I read. And the money could be spent so, so much better. And Mick mentioned Finland, also Norway, where they actually do try and rehabilitate. Rehabilitation in Irish prisons is a myth. It doesn't happen at all.
Okay. Listen, it's a fascinating book, and actually, like, it might be the beginning of more of a broader conversation about this. By the way, there's a few people sending in indignant texts about your comment that back when you were leaving school, the bright guys got to go to the bank, the thicker ones got the guards or the prison service. No offence to guards or prison officers. And I know you're making a joke at yourself there.
Tongue in cheek, Brendan.
Yeah, you should know. You can't say anything tongue in cheek anymore these days, right? PC. Listen, David MacDonald and Mick Clifford, absolutely fascinating. Thank you. The book is called Unlocked, An Irish Prison Officer Story, and it's published by Sandy Cove. And best of luck, David, with the rest of your life. Okay, we'll take a break.
Text 51551. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.